Hi, my name's Jan Rothschild. I'm the director of the Deaf's Poetry Series. And for those of you who didn't sign the mailing list when you came in, if you would like to receive information about the River Styx events, please sign the mailing list. There are a lot of new faces here tonight, and we have a nice series that'll be happening next year, and we have another couple of readings that are happening this year. And if you put your name on the mailing list, you'll receive information. Diane Ackerman is an intrepid pilot, horsewoman, scuba diver, and a visiting professor at Washington University. On the way over here, she was telling me that she's only a fair weather flyer, however. She is not licensed for foul weather, but at any rate, she's brave to get up there. She was born in Waukegan, Illinois, and she received her BA from Pennsylvania University and an MFA, MA, and PhD from Cornell University. In addition to her collections of poetry, which are The Planets, A Cosmic Pastoral, Wife of Light, and most recently, Lady Faustus, she has also written a prose memoir, Twilight of the Tenderfoot. Her poetry and prose appear regularly in the New York Times, the American Poetry Review, the Kenyon Review, the Washington Post, Paris Review, Sites, and other journals and quarterlies. She won the Black Warrior Poetry Prize in 1981, and the Abby Copps Poetry Prize in 1974. Zoe, which is one of the poems in Lady Faustus, was selected for the Pushcart Prize 8, Best of the Small Presses, which is edited by Bill Henderson. We hope, we in St. Louis, hope to entice Diane Ackerman to stay here and teach here. And if she does, I'm sure that our community will be greatly enriched. And I would like to welcome Diane Ackerman.
Thank you so much for that lovely introduction. And thank all of you for coming out on a night as miserable as this, especially when the Academy Awards are going on at home. It's really loyalty to poetry. I'd like to start by reading a kind of sexy poem. This is by no means the sexiest poem that I've ever written, almost certainly. That is a poem in Wife of Light that caused my mother to say, couldn't you wait till I was dead? That one is about an Appaloosa stallion. You can go check that out by yourselves. This is a poem about two scuba divers making love underwater. They are making love at about 100 feet, bottom of the Caribbean. And usually when I've finished reading, people come up and ask technical questions about this, and I'll just tell you straight off, I probably can't answer them. It's called A Fine, A Private Place. He took her one day under the blue horizon, where long sea fingers parted like beads, hitched in the doorway of an opium den, and canyons mazed the deep reef with hollows, cul-de-sacs, and narrow boudoirs, and had to ask twice before she understood his stroking her arm with a marine feather, slobbery as aloe pulp, was wooing, or saw the octopus in his swimsuit stretch one tentacle and ripple its silky bag. While bubbles rose like globs of mercury, they made love mask to mask, floating with oceans of air between them, she, his sea geisha, in an orange kimono of belts and vests, her lacquered hair waving as indigo hamlets tattooed the vista and sunlight cut through the water, twisting its knives into corridors of light. His sandy hair and sea blue eyes, his kelp thin waist and chest ribbed wider than a sandbar, where muscles domed clear and taut as shelves, freckled cowries, flat brawny scallops the color of dawn, his sea-battered hands gripping her thighs like tawny starfish and drawing her close as a pirate vessel to let her board. Who was this she loved? Overhead, sponges sweating raw color jutted from a coral arch. Clown wrasses hovered like fireworks, and somewhere an abalone opened its silver wings. Part of a lusty dream under aspic, Her hips rolled like a Spanish galleon. Her eyes swam and chest began to heave. Gasps melted on the tide. Knowing she would soon be breathless as her tank, he pumped his brine deep within her, letting seawater drive it through petals delicate as anemone veils to the dark purpose of a conch-shaped womb. An ear to her loins would have heard the sea roar. When panting ebbed and he signaled, okay, as lovers have asked land or water-bound since time heaved ho, he led her to safety, shallower realms, heading back toward the boat's even keel, though ocean still petted her cell by cell, murmuring along her legs and neck, caressing her with pale, endless arms. Later, she thought often of that blue boudoir, pillow soft and filled with cascading light, where together they'd made a bell that dumbly clanged beneath the waves, and minutes lurched like mountain goats. She could still see the quilted mosaics that were fish, twitching spangles overhead, still feel the ocean inside and out, turning her evolution around. She thought of it miles and fathoms away, often, at odd moments, watching the minnow snowflakes dip against the window frame, holding a sponge idly under tap gush, sinking her teeth into the cleft of a voluptuous peach. I had a young woman come up to me after a reading and tell me that she was the woman in that poem, but she wouldn't identify herself any farther than that. Can you all hear me all right in the back? This is a small poem about real amphibians, and it's called Amphibians. There's a nice broken-down swimming pool back of the house where I live in Ithaca part of the year. The bad news is that it does mean that every summer you have to run out with a skimmer and try to save the lives of all the things that have fallen in during the night, and they're usually treading frantically still by the morning. Amphibians. All season, we've tried to keep frogs from diving deeper into the chlorine-laced pool. We run skimmers twitching to scoop them out, but no use. Three frogs dead in the filter again today. Weightless things, water pithed, their limbs cast open wider than in field life, each muscle lax as a broken shade. Wan eyes hug shut as if in light contemplation, and out of sight, beneath the limp, leathery skin, a genetic code mixes like alphabet soup. Each tiny ladder split rungless now for this final climb down to Earth. As Jan mentioned, for my sins, I am a pilot. Good literary tradition of pilots, people like Muriel Rukeyser and Howard Nemiroff and all sorts of folk. And I'd like to try a poem or two out on you about flying. First one is called Climbing Out, and that's a technical term. It's part of the process of taking off. You're rushing down the runway. You pull the nose of the airplane up a little bit, and then what happens after that is called climbing out, as you climb up to the altitude that you wish. Blue fluid in my limbs, momentum buoys me up at takeoff speed, as I lose ground for that puzzle older than hearsay, whose thraldom is a witless bird navigating a meadow. Then, heavily afloat, I run the river rapids we know only by effect, smoke chugging downwind, apple boughs swinging their fruit like censers, the heat mirage gusty over Lake Cayuga when, as now, it's flat steel burning in the sun. Below me, planes sit nose up on the airfield like energy resting, only cloud puffs high above. At 3,000 feet, hard a tilt, I stall, and a warning buzzer screams like a marmoset loose in the cabin. The hull trembles, shudders twice, like a woman gently coming, then nestles straight down toward quilted green and bedrock till I get wind of the right attitude for lying long on the air, and land like someone tripping over toys in the darkness, stagger, lurch, recovered fall. But late at night, still awake in the birdless, starless black of my bedroom. I am the moon rinsed with glitter, floating full over a pokey and obedient land. I am motion unmasked by a wafer of steel. I am lift made visible. I am a dancer with starched coattails for wings. I am the mouth of a river whose source is the sky. I am trembling and hot from this power on stall. I am flight luscious. I am kneeling on air. Lindbergh, half his life, he parachuted from open cockpits in swamp fog, and the other madly scouted for where forced landings might work. It was a tick, his mind painting crashes as he flew, knowing pilots lived only an average 900 hours aloft, while at the same time eagle-eyeing the stagnant autumn of the fields, the village life which, as a farm boy, he knew from the soil up to invisible rivers and culverts of air. Lost, he'd buzz a country to see what language the store signs spoke, then reclimb the stairs of flight to where he loved being a hermit in a wooden cabin in the clouds. He always carried a Minnesota boyhood with him, that frozen winter quiet so raw he felt a trespasser, the ocean glaring white and inhuman far below with enormous cakes of jammed ice, as he steered alone by a compass reflected in a lady's compact. He figured plane and heart would never quit. How can a whirlwind stall? Never feared the wind streaming at tornado speed over fuselage and wing, nor the silk he would blossom to the ground in so often as if rehearsing a final cocoon. Above all, there was no mystery to life's steepest thrill, the stick vibrant in his hand, a quart of stagger in the engine, death stowed away in every bolt and copper wire, all existence reaching from one horizon to the next, spangled, perilous, interflowing, dumb, in the same instant, supreme and completely without value, hung on nothing, a few valves and a strut. It's a small poem about spiders. It's really about poets. There's no clue to that if you just encounter the poem in a book. Spiders. The eight-legged aerialists of the tented dawn are up and about. One leaves a pale orchid, its exoskeleton, on a twig, while another fly casts against the wind, angling for the leaf where it would sooner be. The silk hardens and it crosses tiptoe the tiny span, eager to turn mummies from wing crisp to liquid caramel. They dote on the tang of quarry, however they nab it, with trap door or purse web or keen jagged fangs, holding out for that bronchial shudder of the net, when something angel faint, ensnared and hairy, begins the tussle in rigged silk that can start a greedy eye, make gossamer hum, and at long last even their slack jams quiver. I don't know if you people tend to hang out in language labs like I do. It's not just because there are all these people wearing pilots' headsets, although that would be reason enough. I like to hear the simultaneous lamenting in many different languages of essentially the same themes. Remember how language labs work? Everybody says the same sentence over and over, but they just take out one noun and change it, or one verb. This is the language lab at Cornell University. Doing Spanish, a young girl resumes her lament briskly in a blood-chilling monotone. My father is very sick. He is growing thin and pale. Yes, my mother is sick too, and we are terribly worried. For half an hour, a slim marzipan-y voice renders color, fruit, and weather in French. He orders lunch in a cafe, then his mood sours. I was hungry, he moans to his tape recorder, and mispronouncing only one vowel, says instead, I had a woman. Sniggers from the Belgians and Ghanaians. A black face drifts round the booth wall like a nimbus, fam, not fam. He wags a long finger. Bad trouble, you mix them. Hunched over a machine, a Syrian mutters, I am not your sister. I am nobody's sister. A Bolivian boy waves from a corner seat, his teeth fiery in the bomb-bright neon. Hola, Diana. How's your sick family today? His new English wobbles like a first bicycle. About the same, I answer, dragging off my headset. Mom's dying. Dad's still in that same auto wreck. I'm sorry, so terribly sorry, a Korean vows as if telling Hail Marys. So sorry, so terribly sorry, so sorry. While a spiky redhead repents in Portuguese for all the heresy and lust she looks forward to. Only false gods rule in this babble of curt pleas and one-syllable verbs, where the heart's always blunt enough to slap a noun on, and too willingly the felt dissolves in the sayable. The room swells with an extra Afghan, Thai, or Swede, and the occasional onlooker, trying to make sense of it, finds the world shrunk to 25 bright islands, an archipelago of madness and regret. Thank you. I don't think they'll ever let me back. I spent some time in Pittsburgh, and I lived in a residential hotel while I was there. It was frequented only by shut-ins, courtesans, mafiosi, and visiting poets. So the to-ings and fro-ings each day were very entertaining. And also, my apartment was right at eye level with an enormous plaster saint, Saint Benedict the Moor. What's interesting about the saint is that he was arranged on the church with his back to the slum area. He was looking out at the civic arena that the people from the ghetto area could dream about as a form of escape, all the sports they could take part in. Here's a poem called Lines Written in a Pittsburgh Skyscraper. It has taken me 3 years to come to this view. I know now that the body is a river whose bones and muscles and organs are flowing. I have watched their shapes in the molded Allegheny, contained and onrushing, below bridge after bridge vertebra to the Ohio, a brown river that still powers the mind, lying long in the trestle arms of this city, whose sentence is hard labor. Eye level, atop a church across the street, Saint Benedict the Moor stands open-armed and giant, his back turned to the fuming of a ghetto, where some evenings the brightest vision is the flash of a street lamp on a jogger's white Nikes. At night, the red sirens spinning mute across the river converge like pulsars at some accident or crime. An hour later, one pulls off, hovers at a distance, all is gesture and sign. My students are the children of coal miners who watch the ground swallow their fathers each day, sometimes even digesting the trapped men, turning their bones back into lime, into coal. It is the oldest fear that earth may recall you. Along the top of Mount Washington lies a stole of color unnatural to sky, twilight's blue collar. But the mountains are a fishing village, steep, hardy, and solid. At night, the lights and stars from my window make the cityscape an Ethiopian bride. As cars bolt around a curve of street lamps, their shadows flash from under them like sprung souls, and the river churning its wet, whispery thighs, the river pouring blood dark under the bridges. In the river, I find my astonished limbs and all the stateless gels within me, carnal, mute, wholly flowing, unburdened toward a distant shore. I hope to do some writing about the Mississippi also while I'm here. Not too long ago, there was a conference of atmospheric physicists talking about what the outcome would be of even a pocket-sized nuclear war, and it was all very scary, especially when they talked about nuclear winter and what would happen. I promised myself at that point that I would write a poem about nuclear winter, read it at every reading, at least this year, and do whatever I could for the anti-nuclear movement. This is called Nuclear Winter. It'll be coming out in Science 84 in a little while. Men with souls luminous as watch dials are talking about winter. When the sun is white cotton in a perishable sky, when dust clouds thicken over the earth, water sours and plants forget how to green, when summer begins at 20 below, and then the seasons fail all living things. These are possible terrors. Moments ago, we were speechless shadows on the savanna. Moments ago, foragers and hunters of small game. Moments ago, we were tamers of wild beasts, builders of cities. Moments ago, with dreams dark and lusty as roans, we raised families amid the opera of fall leaves and below the deep blue baritone of the summer sky. Moments ago, we were magicians using fabulous machines to shove our bodies into the sky or around the planet, in wires, in lights, in pulses, incomparable. In the Bronx Zoo Ape House, an exhibit sign tags, this is the sign, the most dangerous animal in the world. Behind the bars, in the mirror, my friends and I have not forgotten that message. We know the earth is a clock we can overwind. When Stone Age moods mix with Jet Age weapons, history is lost and all its lessons turn counterfeit. We know the calendar can begin tearing off its own pages. Doom gardeners have planted orchards of nuclear warheads. If they ripen, we perish. In Washington and Moscow, grown men are out daring one another with playground bravado, and on this the future of child and hollyhock depends. Oh, my planet, where I have lingered among the simple daily marvels of egg and leaf, where I have tried to be a modest and able watcher of the skies and of the earth, whose green anthem I love. You are captained by madmen and bullies you do not deserve. Oh, my planet, grass luscious with all the adages of summer, we have forgotten that you are fragile and soft-petaled, or we are lost. Forgotten that you are all green fugues in a solar opus, where shrimp and polar bear must spawn, or we are lost. Forgotten how many footfalls from the cave we have toddled, how deftly we must pad the catwalk of our desire, or we are lost. Moments ago, we were veldt walkers, forged by curiosity. How have we come to be exterminating angels, fat cats at the top of the food chain, who slaughter one another with excuses and would sooner doom our children's faces than lose face? For almost half my lifespan, I have lived on this planet, but I still do not understand the wicked beauty of the atom or understand the Easter Island of the human heart. But I understand winter. In the storm watch for upstate New York, a gray drizzle is falling straight down, stagnant, quiet, as if forever. The deer who leapt fences into our yard to savor summer apples still sweet under the snow have not come for days. Paul is freeing the windsock, twisted and crazy from an impetuous wind. Indoors, I have turned the lily round once again because it cannot find an angle on the sun. In each of us, there is a live beating whose Morse code spells peace, but we are small radiant forms in a vast white madness. Thank you. I felt a little embarrassed about reading a political poem or writing a political poem, and then it occurred to me, of course, that it's not political, it's a human issue. I'd like to read you two more poems, if I may. One is a birthday poem for my goddaughter, Zoe. This is the daughter of Davis Sobel, a science writer for the New York Times. You may have followed her plight in the articles that were published weekly last year in the New York Times. She was volunteered to go into a sleep lab in Montefiore Hospital, spend a month there having her circadian rhythms studied, and she was subjected to all manner of torment while she was there. When she got out, she conceived my goddaughter Zoe, as she put it, between the taxi cab and the apartment. New York is a strange place. It's possible. Zoe, ultimate immigrant who passed through the Ellis Island of your mother's hips with a name slit loose from its dialect of cell and bone, welcome to the citadel of our lives. We listened for the hoofbeats, your heart, for 9 months, and then your mother nearly died hospitably to give you light. Like an Hawaiian princess, you are carried everywhere, on a litter, in a carriage, by the arabesque of one's arm. Your feet have never touched ground. You, who can't even roll over when you want, creamy little tyrant, control the lives of all around you. Sound leaps from your face, and your ribs quake each time the downy world chafes. Last week, you first smiled because grown-ups acted silly. Things elude you, but you can grasp absurdity already. By mistake, you suck your wrist instead of mother's nipple. We laugh. With your operatic cries and Michelin man pudge and seepages from below and eyes alert as twin deer, you have no sense of self, whatever. Zoe Klein, goddaughter with a hybrid name, living in the soft new crook of your mother's arm, with a face like a Dalai Lama's or a small Neanderthal's. Born out of a dream by two, you live a dream by halves now, slumbrous, milky-breathed. In time, love will answer questions you didn't raise. A belled marvel, the cat of your inquiry, will stalk through a world brighter and more plural than you guess, where a baby's fingerprints, loopy weather systems, one for each tip, will leave you spellbound that matter could come to this. And finally, I'd like to read a poem that I was asked to write, a very difficult poem for me. It's an old-fashioned love poem to an extraterrestrial. This is very tough for a descriptive poet, figure out what the extraterrestrial would look like. I decided instead to make it a celebration or a love poem to all things that we find alien. And I think because I saw the Cocteau film Beauty and the Beast 11 times, and we'll see it a 12th if I have opportunity, that is why the alien is addressed in this poem as Beast. I assume whatever he, she, it looks like, it will seem beastly to us, but we will have many things in common. Ode to the Alien. Beast, I've known you in all love's countries, in a baby's face, knotted like walnut meat, in the crippled obligato of a polio-stricken friend, in my father's eyes, pouchy as two marsupials, in the grisly radiance of a winter sunset, in my lover's arm, veined like the Blue Ridge Mountains. To me, you are beautiful until proven ugly. Anyway, I'm no cosmic royalty either. I'm a bastard of matter, descended from countless rapes and invasions of cell upon cell upon cell. I crawled out of slime. I swung through the jungles of Madagascar. I drew wildebeest on the caves at Lascaux. I lived a grim life, hunting peccary and maize in some godforsaken mudhole in the veldt. I may squeal from the pointy terror of a wasp or shun the breezy rhetoric of a fire. But whatever your form, gait, or healing, you are no beast to me. I, who am less than a heart flutter from the brute, I, who have been beastly so long. Like me, you are that pool of quicksilver in the mist,
fluid, shimmery, fleeing, called life. And life full of pratfall and poise, life where a bit of frost one morning can turn barbed wire into a string of stars. Life aromatic with red-hot pizzazz drumming ha-cha-cha through every blurt, nub sag, pang twitch, war bloom of it. Life as unlikely as a pelican or a thunderclap. Life's our tour of duty on our far-flung planets, our cage, our dole, our reverie. Have you arts? Do waves dash over your brain like tide rip along a rocky coast? Does your moon slide into the night's back pocket, just full when it begins to wane, so that all joy seems interim? Are you flummoxed by that mill pond deep within the atom, rippling out to every star? Even if your blood is quarried, I pray you well and hope my prayer your tonic. I sit at my desk now like a tiny proprietor, a cottage industry in every cell. Diversity is my middle name. My blood runs laps, I doubt yours does, but we share an abstract fever called thought and a common swelter of a sun. So beast, pause a moment. You are welcome here. I am life, and life loves life. Thank you all very much.
In a minute, we're going to take a short break. I have a couple of other announcements to make. Number one, River Styx is sponsoring a reading by Susan Sontag, and the date has changed, and I want to make everyone aware of it. She will be reading from fiction published and unpublished at Edison Theater on April 23rd, not the 16th, at the Garden. So if you have tickets already, we will honor those tickets. If you don't have tickets and you would like to come and hear Susan Sontag read, we have tickets at the door. Jim will be glad to sell you some. They are $5 in advance. They are $6 at the door, and they're $4 for students and senior citizens. The other announcement I have is that on May the 7th, Pamela Haddis, I've been cut off, Pamela Haddis and Nan Sweet are going to read here at Duff's, and it starts at 8 o'clock, and there are no tickets in advance. So now we're going to take a break, and we'll be back in a minute.